Today is August 15th. This is Sean Conley interviewing Mr. John Spritzler. We are in Boston, Massachusetts, and this is the first audio file of the Dartmouth Oral History Project.
Actually, we're in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Are we in Brookline? Oh, we're in Brookline, Massachusetts. So I'm sitting down today with Mr. John Spritzler, all right, John, I'm first going to kind of start this off just by asking you to start by describing your early childhood life, kind of where you're from, where you grew up, and your family.
Okay, well, I was born in Los Angeles,
okay.
California, 1947. My father was a cardiologist, and my mother was a housewife.
Okay.
They were both sort of non-religious Jewish, and just a little funny incident about that. When I was in elementary school, it was a Jewish holiday in September, and the Jewish kids didn't have to go to school.
Yeah.
So my mother said I could stay home and play, so I stayed home and played. And then as I was leaving the next day, to leaving the front door of the house to get the school bus, she said, if anyone asks you what religion you are, tell them you're Jewish, and that's how I found out.
So I found out in a very nondescript way.
So it was not a major part of our
sure.
of our life, but... So, when I was 15, my mother was killed in a freak accident by a falling tree caused by the rain, and
wow.
That was sort of a major part of my childhood.
Sure, sure. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
At the time, I had one sister. I later have a half sister from my father's future marriage. But
yeah,
she was three. She's 3 years younger than I am.
Okay.
So in high school, I had a teacher in the 10th grade in a class called Power Reading. I think it was called in Pacific Palisades High School, Palisades High.
Yeah.
Pally High.
Pally High.
And her name was Rose Gilbert, and she died last year, or even less than a year ago. But shortly before she died, she was on national TV because she was still teaching at the age of 93.
Wow. And was she...
She was the oldest...
Living teacher.
Public school teacher teaching still.
Yep.
In the country. So she had this amazing class that she taught us the methods of propaganda. And she had us doing homework that consisted of watching TV ads
mm-hmm.
and identifying the methods of propaganda. So she was quite a lady. She was very...
Sure. It sounds like this class stands out to you.
Hmm?
It sounds like this class really stands out to you from your middle... Elementary school classes?
No, this is high school. 10th
high school
grade,
classes,
yeah.
Okay.
So it was in that class that we were instructed to write an expository essay. That was an essay that making an argument for some
sure.
case. And I remember that we had to write this essay, and what we learned is that it had to have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So the first essay that I ever wrote was one in which I argued that that President Kennedy had been too soft on Russia and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
I can't believe that I'm the same person that wrote that article, but
that's
what I wrote.
What was some of the context that made you think that? Was it?
Well, we'd just come out of the Cuban Missile Crisis,
yeah.
You know, and we were all scared to death. We were going to die. Some people... had shelters, you know, nuclear bomb
sure.
shelters and so forth, and most, of course, didn't. And I don't know why, but that's what I wrote. You know? I mean, you know.
Was it like a topic you discussed with your friends, with your father?
No, we just had to write something, and that's what I decided to write.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, it's just, I don't remember a whole lot from my childhood, but I remember some things, and that's one of the things that I remember.
Sure.
And I also remember that, Goldwater was getting the nomination, the Republican nomination around 1964, shortly before then. I was a Goldwater fan. Mm. I remember when Kennedy was assassinated, of course I remember where I was and everything. I was in a Shakespeare class and the news came over a speaker at the top of the blackboard. I was shocked. Of course, it was totally unexpected and everything, but yep. I wasn't as hysterically upset as I remember there were girls in my class who just went absolutely hysterical, you know, and I was sort of looking at that and wondering, you know, why are they that hysterical, you know? Mm-hmm. So my parents were for Stevenson, who lost the nomination, and maybe that had something to do with it, I don't know, but
sure.
They were extremely moderate Democrats.
Okay. And it was tell me kind of about some of the was politics kind of a common conversation in the home?
Not particularly. No,
okay.
No. I think the thing I admired about Goldwater was his being sort of contrarian more than the substance of
sure.
What he said.
And he certainly had a following in Southern California, correct?
I guess he did.
Yeah.
You know, he had me.
He had you. I see. Was this kind of awareness or discussion of political candidates, was that kind of common among in your high school, among your peers?
Well, I didn't have at the time I had two very close friends.
Yep.
And neither of them went to the same school as I did.
Okay.
And so my whole sort of social life was not really mainly with people in my high school. It was with these two good friends that we hung out together all the time. I don't remember having much, I don't remember talking politics particularly. I'm sure, you know, we didn't avoid it, but
sure.
It wasn't like a focus. I was into science. Mm-hmm.
What were you interested in?
Well, I was, my best friend and I, we had ham radio licenses, and we built a Morse code translator. I mean, we spent years in the workshop that we had behind my where I lived.
Sure.
Tinkering, and we built this Morse code translator. I remember we won, I think, the Western State Science Fair. We won first place or something with it. You know, it was this amazing device. You put the speaker in front of the radio where the Morse code's coming out of, and it would type up what the Morse code was on an electric typewriter.
Wow.
Which was a big deal, having an electric typewriter back then.
Sure, sure.
We got our hands on an IBM something or another with, I think it had a ball, you know. Do you remember those? Do you ever see one?
Yeah. what got you into science? Was it just a curiosity? It was something that you liked from early on, or
It was just I remember when I wrote my college admission. You know, the person I most admired it was Albert Einstein. Mm-hmm. I'd read a book about his theory of relativity, and it was cool. I was interested in that. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, we're talking about the years, you know, leading up to 1964 when I graduated from high school.
Yeah.
At that time, I do remember distinctly feeling that the United States was a wonderful country, and I was so fortunate to be living in it, and the world was my oyster, and just extremely happy to be living where I was when I was, you know, and looking forward to an exciting future.
Sure.
And, you know, so I was doing okay in school and got accepted at Dartmouth, the only Ivy League school that accepted me. I had to apply to all of them, right? And, but if I hadn't gotten into Dartmouth, I would have gone to Berkeley where all my friends went, you know, so. So that my, the the civil rights issue was not on my mind. The war was just barely on anybody's mind back then, certainly not particularly on my mind. So I was building gadgets and ham radio and that kind of stuff. That was the way it was.
Tinkering around. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Can I clarify? Did you live in... what part of L.A. did you live in? Was it...
I lived in Brentwood, which is where O.J. Simpson much, 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 much later moved to. The house that I grew up in was sort of like a residential street. And it was, a nice part of Los Angeles. Sure. Western Los Angeles. It was... my father was a cardiologist and movie star patients and everything, so he was doing well financially. But when my sister and I went back just to reminisce, to see the old house, it had turned into a gated community.
Yeah.
We couldn't even get in, I mean, it's crazy,
Wow.
And that's where O.J. Simpson was living much, 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 much,
much
later.
Much later. And you sounds like you enjoyed the community, felt comfortable there.
Enjoyed what?
Enjoyed the community.
I was a Boy Scout.
You're a Boy Scout?
Yeah, local troop, bike ride, a short bike ride to the church where they met and, camping trips. And I remember just as a, my friends and I, we'd ride our bikes everywhere. We'd ride our bikes all the way almost to downtown Los Angeles to go to Army Surplus stores to get electronic components and relays and stuff like
that.
And there was no fear then, of kids riding their bike anywhere, miles and miles and miles away and so forth. That's another theme, but the fear that exists in the country today about letting kids, be anywhere on their own is dramatically different than it was back then.
I'm guessing your mom and your dad were okay with you going out into town.
I could give you a little anecdote about that if you want to hear it. It was 1958. I was 12 years old. My sister was 9 years old. My grandfather was in New York City. He was a gossip columnist, and my father was taking a sabbatical, and we were going to Europe, and they were, my sister and I were going to be dropped off in Switzerland for about 8 months.
Oh, wow.
While he was, and my mother were in London, he was doing some medical kind of sabbatical thing. So we were in New York visiting my grandfather, and so he got us tickets for a matinee showing of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, which maybe you've heard of it.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the longest running successes.
You've seen
it. They're very funny, right?
Yeah.
So they dropped my sister and me off at the theater.
Yeah.
And they said, when the show's over, walk home. And we'd never been in New York City before. I'm 12, she's 9. We're not New Yorkers, right? We're not streetwise at all. And the instructions are to walk about 10 blocks, back from the theater to my grandfather's apartment. If you think about it, if parents did that today, they'd probably be arrested. But no one thought anything about it back then. Here's the funny part of the story. It's not related to the... my sister and I believe, are the only people to ever walk out in the middle of that show. And the reason is, we were enjoying it and laughing and everything, and then the curtain came down and everyone got up and walked out. So we got up and walked out and headed back to my grandfather's. We got there and he said, looked at his watch, he said, "What are you doing here now?" And he says, "Well, the show's over, we came home." We didn't understand it was the intermission. We didn't know anything about it. No one told us about that.
Sure. That was nice. I'll go now.
But the thing about the important thing about that incident is how the fear of kids walking home in New York City didn't exist then.
Sure. Tell me about your grandfather.
His name was Louis Sobel. He was a famous person. He was asked to host the Ed Sullivan Show, and then he turned it down because he had a big nose that he was embarrassed. So he was okay on radio, but didn't want to be on television.
Interesting.
And he was a syndicated columnist, so your grandfather would probably know his name. He wrote, it was him and Walter Winchell. Okay. Walter Winchell revealed the dirt about people. My grandfather was famous for only saying nice things about them.
Was your grandfather close with your family? Was your grandfather on your father's side or your mom's side?
My mother's side.
Mother's side. Yeah. Okay. And did you see him often? Or
he would come out occasionally to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Occasionally see him then, and I saw him a few times.
Sure.
When I was in college, I stopped there on my way to Dartmouth as a freshman.
Yeah.
And so forth, but. He was mortified. He was very close friends with Senator, what's his name? One of the big senators who was, I guess, from New York, very pro-war. I can't remember the senator's name. It starts with a G, but he was good friends with the senator.
Okay.
And at Dartmouth graduate.
So this is the second audio file of the August 15th interview with Mr. John Spritzler. We refer to QuickTime Player on my MacBook Pro as a secondary backup after the recorder was no longer able to store any additional files. So, John, if you'd like to take it where we left off.
Okay, so I was getting my diploma. After I took my diploma in hand, I said to Senator Gruning, hi, I'm Louis Sobel's grandson, and extended my hand for a handshake, and he grinned and smiled, and then I said, I think that you're a criminal for voting for, funds for the war in Vietnam, and his face completely changed, he was horrified, and my grandfather was mortified later when he found out about it, of course, so that's...
Gotcha. So that's the connection to your grandpa. That's funny. So we've been talking about your high school. We've been talking about growing up in LA. We also talked about your kind of extracurriculars and hobbies and interests. So what was high school like for you? High school and middle school. And we talked about some of your classes, but if you could just kind of describe what that environment was like.
When I was in elementary school, I was a C-minus student.
Mm-hmm.
And when it got to sixth grade, because of the changes in the borders of the schools, the LA schools, for the sixth grade and only for the sixth grade, I was in the same school as my best friend,
okay.
David. And
David
was an A student.
Okay.
And we were in the same class, and we were best friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the teacher saw that we were best friends and assumed that I must be an A student too. So I started getting A's. And I guess it was a good thing for me because it made me think that I was smart enough to, think of myself as smart instead of dumb. And so that was an important thing. Totally chance, right?
Obviously,
I didn't change from one to the other. But I started hanging out with the right crowd and that in terms of grades. Anyway, Then we were separated, different schools again, because of the shifting school borders, and that was the end of elementary school, and it was junior high school and so forth. I don't know what to say about my, those years. I was, and by the time I was in high school, I was in advanced placement classes and working real hard. They had me go to UCLA with some other students for some courses in my senior year, there was a track system. There were the kids that, were in shop and that you never had anything to do with. And there were the kids that were in advanced placement. It was a clear class
distinction
divide.
Was there a tension ever between those groups that you perceived?
No, we just basically ignored each other.
Okay.
It's my recollection.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you did your classes, they took theirs.
Yeah, no, there weren't fights or anything like that.
Sure.
It's just, things were very undramatic. How can I put it that way? It was very undramatic.
Okay. Well, yeah, anyway, is that just a function of kind of people going about their business, or?
I guess so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just straightforward.
Life was not problematical then. As I said, I was totally optimistic about my life and happy where I was. And.
But you're still paying attention to present events. I mean, you talked about your essay.
Yeah, I guess so. But, yeah. You know, Kennedy wasn't hard enough against the Russians.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what I know now is that we all came near to dying because of the nuclear war.
But. Sure. And, did you, what were your interactions with your family and friends during the crisis like?
During the missile crisis?
Yeah, during and just after.
I don't really have strong memories. We were afraid.
Yeah.
Everyone was afraid. No one, you know, we just sort of waited it out in fear. That's my memory of it.
Okay.
I don't remember scenes from that time, so it's, I can't say too much.
Sure. Sure. Okay. That's interesting. And, you went through your courses, you mentioned that science was kind of a standout for you. Did you take a focus on science in high school as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one didn't have too much choice in what one took. I took, the math courses and chemistry and biology. I remember, Russia just put Sputnik up, and so there was this panic in American education that they weren't teaching American kids science. So the new curriculum was all, you know, this is going to catch us up to the Russians, you know. Mm-hmm. There was ecology was a little bit beginning to be talked about for the very first time.
Yeah.
You know, the word had never been heard before. And I took chemistry, But no physics.
No physics.
Yeah, chemistry, just a biology and a chemistry
okay.
class. That was it. It wasn't like a super scientific background.
Okay. Any classes you were enjoying or really not enjoying? Anything that you just didn't look forward to going
actually,
to?
Actually, there was a history course that I hated because it was had an absurd teacher who you had to write term papers. And now this was before computers, before, you know, maybe there was electric typewriters God knows what the technology was then, you know. The term papers would be marked in the following way. He would hold the pages up to the light. And every correction, you lost one grade.
That's
not exactly inspiring one to become a history major, right?
Sure, sure.
And then there was another history course that it wasn't crazy that way, but I remember, I think it was U.S. history, and the teacher told us that the final exam, this was to get into college, you had to get an A, you know, pressure was intense, right,
yeah.
Junior year, that the final exam was going to be a blue book exam.
Okay.
And we were going to have to write essay answers to 4 of the 6 questions, which he gave us way in advance, mm-hmm. which was horrible, because what that meant is that, you know, we had to form teams to basically prepare and memorize answers to all 6 questions.
Wow.
It would have been much kinder if he just said, I'm going to give you some questions and you won't know what they are until the day of the exam,
sure.
right?
Do you remember what the questions were? Or
no,
just
no,
remember
no,
the
no,
kind of the panic with that?
But we formed teams and mm-hmm. we had to memorize. You were so competitive.
Yep.
In fact, I don't think I've ever been in a more competitive situation than 11th grade high school.
Really?
Yeah.
Anyway, competing with your peers?
Well, you're competing to get the grades, to get the A, to get into college.
Sure.
In Palisades High School, which was a new school, it had only opened, I was the first ninth grader in it, first ninth grade class. But in the years 9th, 10th, 11th, and then 12th, I think the pattern continued. Harvard accepted only the class president and always the class president. In other words, if you got elected class president, you knew you would be accepted to Harvard, and you would be the only person in the school accepted to Harvard.
Did the class president end up going to Harvard? Do you remember?
Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure. You know, his name was Peltke. I remember his name. Yeah, you know, that's.
Interesting. Now, so it seems to me that college was a focus for you early on.
Yeah, see, my parents were, from my mother from New York City, my father from Philadelphia, and education was very important, and so it was a big deal. I go to an Ivy League school.
Yeah.
So that's why I had to apply to all the Ivy League schools. And Dartmouth was the one that accepted me. So
gotcha.
That's where I went.
Well, to what extent was your desire to go to these schools, was it you kind of motivating yourself?
No, meant nothing to me.
Meant nothing to you. Okay.
No, I had no idea what Dartmouth was. Dartmouth was just a name.
Yeah.
You know.
But meant a lot to your parents.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And was that something I talked about or brought up a lot, or was it just kind of a...
It was just the atmosphere I grew up in. It was okay. It was just a given, you know. It was like...
Let's see. Still going. Just got nervous because it. So it was the atmosphere you grew up in, and kind of surrounded by. And,
I had no idea what to expect when I got to Dartmouth. By the way, it was all male school then, and I'll just tell you a little funny thing. But it was toward the end of my 4 years there, the issue was being hotly debated whether Dartmouth should go co-ed. Mm-hmm. There were, as I recall, two opinions, and only two opinions. Opinion number one should not go co-ed, because if it did, that would make it worse for the men. Opinion number two, it should go co-ed, because if it did, that would make it better for the men.
Interesting. So we talked about your junior year. What was senior year like for you? You know, you mentioned at the very end you felt
pretty... Oh, in high school?
Yeah, in high school.
I don't have a big recollection of the difference between the one and the other.
Really?
A little bit easier because you already knew what your college decision was.
So you found out, when did you find out that you had gotten into Dartmouth?
I remember writing the application during Christmas vacation. That's all I remember.
Wrote it, sent it in, found out that spring.
Yeah.
What was it like when you first found out, and how did you find out?
You know, you get a thick letter instead of a skinny letter.
still
all the other ones were skinny letters.
Gotcha. So you knew you were going to Dartmouth.
When I arrived at Dartmouth,
it
was freshman orientation week. Guess who was in charge of freshman orientation week? A freshman.
Really?
Guess who?
Who?
Bob Reich, future Secretary of Labor.
Wow.
Under Clinton.
Wow.
Who I came to, I have very negative feelings towards Bob Reich, but they didn't exist that early. But
sure.
But it was strange that he was a freshman just like me, but he was in charge.
Put in charge. Kind of talk about your early, very early freshman year of Dartmouth.
Let me tell you just some things that I've been thinking about in preparation for this.
Okay.
That are sort of interesting, I think. My chronology is a little bit blurry. You know, I say freshman year, it might have been sophomore year. I can't be positive about those things. But in my early arrival at Dartmouth, there are two things I remember that stand out. Allen Ginsberg, you know the poet Allen, the Beat poet, right? Mm-hmm. Allen Ginsberg was invited to give a talk. It was a talk in someone's living room. I don't remember exactly where it was. On the campus.
On campus.
It was a fraternity house. I can't remember, but I remember it being not so much like a fraternity house, but being sort of dainty.
Okay.
Like maybe it was the wife of some professor made it
So dainty. Somewhere in Hanover, but not...
No, right on the campus, right close to the campus.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, close to the green, or...?
Yeah, right close to the green, somewhere, I can't remember exactly where, but anyway, it was an intimate kind of thing. And there was Allen Ginsberg with his boyfriend, Peter Orlovsky.
Yep.
And I was this, basically I was like a freshman, I was like being introduced to the world of ideas and great things for the first time. Mm. What did I know? I didn't know anything, right? So I'm sitting there listening to the great poet, Allen Ginsberg, and he starts talking. And what is he talking about? He's talking about the turds, the little pieces of shit that play such an interesting role to him when he is having anal intercourse with his boyfriend.
Right off the bat.
In graphic detail.
And how did the audience respond to this?
I was shocked.
You were shocked?
I can't remember anything else about it. Okay, yeah. That's vignette number one.
Okay.
Vignette number two. Again, maybe it was my sophomore year. There was a speaker, a guy from New York City, who was speaking about something called apartheid in South Africa, a word I'd never heard of before. But, you know, you go to interesting events, you see them advertised, you know, you want to learn about things, that's why you're in college, right?
Sure.
So I go to this talk about apartheid in South Africa, and he said the most horrible things about South Africa, unbelievable things, mm-hmm. you know, about apartheid and everything. And I remember, you know what my reaction was? He must be lying.
Really? What made you think that?
It was too outrageous.
Okay.
And then I remember I had a friend, I forget his name, who was a little more savvy than I was about the world and things, and he showed me that actually he wasn't lying. and interestingly, within a year or so after that, I was a member of the organization that speaker was recruiting for.
Interesting.
Which was a communist Marxist organization.
Okay.
More on that later, maybe. But so I was a babe in the wood, you know. And then there was the civil rights movement. I was learning about Jim Crow, and I remember in my freshman year, I gave a donation of $50, which was a lot of money for a freshman in 1964 or 5, to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Stokely Carmichael's group. Mm-hmm. So I was already starting to get involved with issues that I hadn't been involved with in high school.
All right. We'll get to that. I'm curious, you know, if you remember kind of some of the early detail, like the very kind of first couple of weeks at Dartmouth.
Had beer for the first time.
Yeah, beer for the first time. Wait, was it in a dorm? Was it a fraternity? Or
I was walking around the campus. The freshmen were getting drafted to do. Do they still do that? The freshmen get drafted to do work for upperclassmen? No, they don't do that.
Nope.
If you were a freshman, then any upperclassman could say, "Hey, carry this rug upstairs to my, you know, to my dorm room or fraternity room or whatever." Right.
Yeah.
Somehow, in the course of that, I was offered a beer and had my first beer.
Okay. And that was anyway, walking with a group of friends, a group of upperclassmen approached you and kind of whisked you away, or?
I can't remember.
Okay.
I remember the beer.
Gotcha.
We're talking how many years ago? This is, you know.
True. No, that is fair. Do you remember what dorm you were in?
Yes, Cohen.
Cohen, okay.
302A Cohen Hall. And the reason I picked Cohen, it still exists, I think. At least I was, last time I was there, it did, right?
Yeah.
It's a sort of a cinder block, ugly building compared to these gorgeous, big, you know, wooden, old buildings that are, you know, closer to the campus, right?
Sure.
So, but when I was looking at the catalog and picking a dorm, because you could pick, at least you pick your first choice, right?
Yeah.
Stupid me, you know, I see this modern cinder block building, and its modernity said, "Oh, this is the good one," right? And the oldness of the other building said, "Oh, that's an old building. That's no good."
Yeah, yeah.
Little did I know they had large rooms with fireplaces and everything.
Funny. Did you have a roommate?
No. It was a suite.
Okay.
And so I had a single room. I was rather shocked by a few of the other people were from like Phillips in Exeter, and they had they had extremely anti-women, contemptuous views of women. I had never experienced anything really like that.
What do you mean by that?
The talk was about, you know, at a mixer grabbing a girl, put a bag over her head and fuck her, you know. That's pretty sharp, yeah. Right? And that was just like, they were just constantly, that was the theme. And it was shocking to me.
Yeah. You know? And it's like, you had, you know, I'm guessing you never kind of heard that kind of, just talk before.
I never talked that way.
Yeah.
No one I knew talked that way, yeah, about girls. But these kids from, they were from the private, it was a culture.
Yep.
It was Exeter and Phillips Andover and so forth, you know. I don't know where you're from. I hope I'm not stepping on toes, but.
That's interesting. So you lived in the suite. Do you remember your suite mates? Or?
Yeah, we were suite mates. You know.
Yeah.
Right away, they rearranged the common room, so it was someone's room. I don't know. I just mainly was in my single room.
Okay.
My good buddy was a Madagascar student. His name was Andre Namanantenisoa. Mm-hmm. Still remember. Andre Namanantenisoa.
Okay.
And we used to hang around a lot.
Okay.
He introduced me to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, things, you know, that I was not aware of.
Okay.
And we smoked grass together on weekends.
That's cool.
And I think once we planted some marijuana seeds in the President Dickey's lawn, but they didn't germinate.
Didn't take. Gotcha. So what was it like translating socially into Dartmouth? Because it's a really different culture.
I found people that were not like the ones I described, you know, that became friends. And,
okay.
And so I had some friends and, you know, and we hung out together, but, it was funny. Andre, my Madagascar friend, he and I, at his instigation, we would go to the grocery store and buy the makings of a gourmet meal for dinner.
Yeah.
Having no place to cook it. And then we would go to fraternities or anyone we knew with a kitchen.
Sure.
And propose the deal that we would cook a gourmet meal and share it with them if we could use their kitchen, right? Mm-hmm. It was always successful.
You know? Always successful.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, but I didn't have much of a desire to go and get into the fraternities. And I'm not sure why. It just, I didn't. So I had my friends.
Yeah. And you guys hung out on the weekends. You were kind of, anything particular that you guys did? Mm-hmm. Like go to the movies?
Yeah, we always go to the movies. James Bond movies were always new then.
Yeah.
You know, they were coming out then.
Okay.
At the theater. I assume the theater's still there, right? The Nugget Theater?
Yeah, Nugget still stands.
Yeah. Yeah, and road trips occasionally, you know.
To where?
Girls' school, Saratoga. I just remember the one Saratoga. The guy I went for the main. His goal was to get drunk, which he did, and he was vomiting all over. My goal wasn't to get drunk, but you know, I can't remember. If we ran into some girls, it wasn't anything to write home about. But
yeah, interesting. And how would you describe the social scene on campus? And was it predominantly based in the fraternity system or?
I remember is the bizarreness of they would bus in girls from Colby College and some other colleges, depending on when it was, and they would be bussed in, and it was just extremely bizarre.
Yeah,
because they were being bussed in like cattle, and there'd be a so-called mixer, and I basically didn't want to have much to do with it because, you know, the people that I was seeing were talking about putting bags over girls' heads and fucking them, and it wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
So it was a very strange. it was very strange. You know, I lived through it. I found my niche, so to speak, and but that was And I assume it's very different today, you know.
And any traditions that you kind of remember from the fall? Because we're reading about there's something.
Wahoo wah.
Yeah. any of those that you still remember that kind of stuck out to you? Like running, did you have to run the gauntlet as a freshman?
No, I'm not sure about that. I remember, you know, there was the big bonfire in February. You know, after my freshman year, I was involved with organizing against the Vietnam War. I mean, me and my friends were doing that. We were going to demonstrations and you know, organizing things. And I was hanging out with some anarchists in Vermont, and one of whom was a professor, I think Ed Strauss or his wife. I can't remember. One of them was a professor. The other one wasn't, I think.
Okay. I'm curious about the kind of the transition, and you kind of mentioned kind of the Allen Ginsberg event for you. Do you remember some of your early classes at Dartmouth, kind of professors you interacted with?
Well, here's the thing about my major that sort of relates to this. So I when I first arrived at Dartmouth, the plan was I was going to study and become a doctor and be a doctor in practice with my father, but after 6 months or so, I realized I didn't want to do that, so told him. He was a little unhappy. I decided I wanted to be a physicist.
Okay.
Because, remember, Einstein? You know,
yeah.
That was what interested me. So I took the courses. I was thought of myself as a physics major, so I was
in Wilder Hall.
Taking all the physics courses.
Yeah.
And I was doing great in them, you know. I remember once I... One physics course. Do you know Richard Feynman? Does that ring a bell?
No.
Well, he was this amazing guy. He got the Nobel Prize in physics, quantum physics, and everything. And he taught at the West Coast, Caltech, I think it was. You don't remember the Challenger explosion?
No, I
do.
Yeah, I'm aware of it.
Remember the hearings where they were investigating it?
Yeah.
And there was this guy that held up ice water and put an O-ring in the ice water and it got frozen and it became brittle and broke.
Yeah.
That was Richard Feynman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He wrote some great humorous books about his life and everything, but he also wrote this famous three volume set of called Lectures on Physics.
Okay.
So when I was taking one of the first courses in physics at Dartmouth, the book that was the textbook was assigned, I just ignored it. I just read Richard Feynman instead.
Mm-hmm.
Aced the course. I mean, they were great, great lectures.
Yeah.
So I was really into physics, but I was also had become aware that the war in Vietnam, like everybody at the time, you know, we were reading the headlines and seeing events like, you know, the monks immolating themselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, the protest of the war. So I was becoming very, very aware that something was wrong.
Okay.
You know, my pro-Goldwater, life is wonderful, the United States is a great place, was developing cracks.
Yeah.
And the civil rights movement was one of them. You know, the more I knew about the Jim Crow laws and everything, and then the Vietnam War was another big one.
Mm.
And so I decided that that I was going to take a course. This was a great college. This is where all knowledge was. So I wanted to know, why was the United States fighting in Vietnam?
Yeah.
So it's a simple question. And I decided to get the answer to that question, I would take the right history course, and then, you know, that would be the end of it. I'd get the answer and continue with physics, right?
Yeah.
So I took an Asian history course.
Okay.
And
What time era?
It was about Southeast Asia.
And
China, I think. Whatever. The closest I could get, you know.
Okay.
I remember I took an Asian history course. And it was very interesting, but I realized it didn't answer the question. So I figured, well, you know, I took the wrong Asian history course. So next semester I took a different Asian history course.
Okay.
Same thing. It was very interesting, but didn't answer the question. And I did that for a while, and then it occurred to me, you know, stupid me, I should be taking a U.S. history course. You know, the question was about why the United States was doing something. So I took a U.S. history course, same thing, interesting, but no answer. Figured I took the wrong one, took a different one, right?
Yeah.
I think it was my junior year. I got a letter, like everyone gets, a sort of a form letter. And the letter is telling every student who gets it how they stand with respect to their major requirements.
Yeah.
So I'm reading the letter, and it says, congratulations, Mr. Spritzer, you've completed the requirements for your major in history. I nearly dropped to the floor.
So you
had never occurred to me that I was majoring in history.
So
the last thing on my mind.
Interesting. Really?
And I didn't know it until I got the letter saying I'd finished meeting all the requirements for it.
And you're still taking classes in physics at the same time.
And math, yeah.
And math, interesting.
Yeah.
So
not enough to get the major, it turns out.
Interesting. So, you kind of stumbled into it. I'm curious, what was, you kind of mentioned this, like everybody was aware of this at the time. Where must be getting like your news from the Daily Dartmouth, the other news sources?
You know, I wasn't watching television then because I didn't have a television.
Okay.
And, but you know, I don't know, magazines, radio, it's a good question.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was hard to avoid. Not everyone was anti-war because of it, but everyone knew something strange was going on.
Sure.
You know, something.
And did you find it kind of bubbling up more in conversation on campus?
Well, yeah. I mean,
the
years between 64 and 68 were years in which the entire country went from practically nobody opposing the war. By 68, a majority of Americans opposed the war. So it was an extremely rapid period of change in general, and Dartmouth reflected that like everywhere else.
Okay.
You know.
Interesting. So you took these history courses. Was it the content or professors that really kind of led you to?
This is the thing about history that I liked. I had to take a sociology course, Soci 101. In fact, I still have anxiety nightmares because of this course.
Why?
I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I'm a physics major, right?
Yeah.
And physics is physics, you know. And so, but I had to take it for requirements, you know. So I took Soci 101.
Yep.
And one of the first things that happened in the laboratory part of the class was they gave us this big stack of like IBM cards that like about 5 inches tall. And these cards are data cards, and the way the data is entered, this is like so far beyond before your time, you can't believe it, right?
Yeah.
The way the data, each card was the data for a person.
Okay.
A person about whom information was collected about their age and their gender and their religious affiliation, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. And around the perimeter of the card, there were locations. Each location corresponded to the yes or no answer to a question.
Okay.
So at a given point in the perimeter, there would be either a notch or a circle hole.
Okay.
And one represented a yes answer to the question that corresponded to that, like, are you over 40 years old?
Yeah.
Yes or no, right?
Yeah.
Another location would be, are you over 60 years old, right?
Sure.
Narrow it down that way. Are you a Christian? Yes or no. Are you a Protestant? Yes or no, et cetera. And so the exercise required that we find out how many people were Protestants who were between 30 and 50 years old, something like that, right? So, you know, you have this long metal rod. And so you stick the rod down in the hole, indicating Protestant.
Okay.
Okay. And then you lift the rod up, and the ones with a notch would fall away, but the ones with a circle would cling to the rod.
Okay.
So you'd separate according to that yes or no question.
Yeah.
And then the ones that were Protestant, you'd then stick the rod in through the age thing, right?
Yeah.
And so you'd end up with a stack representing the people who were whatever you were trying to find. And so I said to the teaching assistant, I guess it was, or whoever was teaching the section, the lab section, I said, can we answer the question by just measuring the thickness of the stack, getting an approximate thickness and figure out how many cards per inch things were,
sure.
instead of tediously counting, you know, hundreds of cards, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, no, you have to count them. And I knew that if this was physics, you'd measure it, right?
Yeah.
The whole spirit of physics was, you know, you measure, you get a certain degree of accuracy, you live with it, right?
Yeah.
As soon as he said that, I had nothing but contempt for sociology, and I started cutting classes.
Really?
And I cut every class except the class where there was an exam. And at the end of the year, because I was doing that, everyone else would get their corrected exam at the next class,
yeah.
but not me. So at the end of the year, all my exams were still there in the professor's hand, uncollected. So he knew that I wasn't attending class, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if they still have this, but there are two kinds of failure grades. Do they still have this? You wouldn't know because you haven't failed the class yet. But there were two kinds of failures. There was an F, which meant you tried, but you just didn't make the cut. But there was also what was called a flagrant neglect. I got a flagrant neglect. In the course of my academic work at Dartmouth, my grades oscillated for each trimester between all A's and all F's. If you looked at my record, you would see this bizarre, you know, A's, F's. And in large part, it depended on anti-war demonstrations and the timing and what I was interested in, either I was into school or I wasn't.
Yeah, interesting. And did it have anything
to do? I had to explain that
to
get accepted into the doctoral program at the Harvard School of Public Health for biostatistics. I had to explain that record, and they bought it. They accepted it.
They accepted it. Gotcha. And did it have to do with did it have to do with the classes, too? You know, like, if it was a history class or a physics class, were you kind of more tuned in?
Sometimes I was, and sometimes I wasn't. But okay. my anxiety dream, which every now and then I have it. By the way, I've discovered that the people who teach college courses, there was a picnic with the School of Public Health in the department. We all shared our anxiety dreams, and almost all of us have something similar to this.
Yep.
Mine is that I wake up in the morning, I know that it's the final exam for the sociology class, but I don't know where the class meets.
You have to figure it out.
Not a clue.
That's funny. It sticks with you. Do you remember the professor's name?
No.
Gotcha.
Oh, here's the thing. The thing about history, this was a preface to why I liked history.
Yeah.
What I realized about history is that unlike sociology and government and all these other social sciences, all these other social sciences had physics envy. They had envy about the numerical sophistication, right? History didn't. History was about telling the story. Mm. And I really admired that. It was about telling the story, not about, you know, competing with, you know, numerical analysis with, you know, to earn, you know, some kind of credit for being sophisticated.
Right? Sure, sure.
So I've always admired that about history.
I like the appeal. Do you have a certain era of history that, you know, you specialized in?
Well, U.S. history and Asian history during the, you know, that led up to any history that seemed to offer a possibility of answering that one question. Mm-hmm. You know, I studied Japan, you know, the Meiji Restoration and China and the Kuomintang and Southeast Asia, I guess, a little bit. And U.S. history, you know, I can't even remember now. But that was the what determine my choice of history classes.
Okay, gotcha. So I talked about classes. I guess I'm curious about.
Never did get the answer, by the way, in that process.
Fair. I'm curious about kind of the some of the you know, the moments that stand out to you when you started getting involved with activism on campus? Was it just kind of hearing it, being interested, and kind of going to it, or like say a friend kind of pulling you in, or what were some of the factors that brought you to the door?
You know, a number of us that talk to each other about all this stuff all the time. We read the magazines. Ramparts magazine was a big magazine then. And you know, I had these anarchist friends in Vermont who were older, and, you know, we talked
about how'd you get to know them?
What?
How did you get to know them?
Who knows? You know, people get to know each other.
Sure.
They find each other, you know, these interests. So we had a core of people, you know, a handful of people that were, you know, we were anti-war, and we wanted to do something about it. And so we discovered that is the Dartmouth Christian Union still there?
A form of it, yes.
Okay, I became a student board member of the Dartmouth Christian Union.
Yep.
Being Jewish background, it was problematic, but it relates to all the Vietnam War stuff.
Okay.
The head of the Dartmouth Christian Union was the adult person in charge was Reverend George Kalbflush.
Okay.
And he was very, very anti-war and very pro-civil rights. And so he made the Dartmouth Christian Union and the office and the mimeograph machine, which is very important. You know what a mimeograph machine is?
Yep.
I don't think we even had Xerox machines then.
Interesting.
You know, never mind, you know, printers and computers and all that, right? He made, and there was a secretary for the office, the employee. Mm. He made that available to us anti-war people. We eventually made ourselves an SDS chapter, Students for Democratic Society.
Yep.
And that was our home. Do you remember the name of the building? It's next to Parkhurst. It was
McNutt.
What?
McNutt.
Maybe.
So if you're looking at that row, now there's Collis Center.
Yeah.
There's Robinson Hall.
I think we were in Robinson Hall.
Okay. Do you remember what floor?
Like the second floor, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
ROTC
building's right above us.
Okay. So yeah, ROTC was in the same building as you guys?
Right above us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yep.
So that was our home.
All right.
And we'd hang out. They had a lounge with a couch and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So we'd hang out there and you know, do our planning and everything. So we planned different things. We had, as I talk about in that article that you read, what makes a political sea change, we had a peace sign that we stood in front of every Wednesday at noon. And maybe I shouldn't dwell on that particular episode because it's written about.
Yeah.
You can read about it. But and we printed anti-war leaflets, and we organized dorm discussions. You know, I can't remember the details, but we got discussions going in dormitories, mm-hmm. you know, to talk about the war. And we did a lot of that stuff leading up to the big teach-in.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, we organized people to go to the anti-war demonstrations in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and
how receptive did you find campus, at least early on?
Well, at the beginning, it was very unreceptive.
Yeah.
And then as the people in the campus, as well as the entire country, became more anti-war, became more and more receptive. So it was a dramatic change in a short number of years.
Okay.
You know, those years were years of great change.
Yep. So yeah, I knew you did organize dorm discussions, you organized kind of groups to get out there. Do you remember is some of what was talked about in particular in a discussion? Like, you know, what?
There was a lot of focus on the fact that the government was lying about its rationale for the war.
Okay. What do you mean by that?
Well, there was a history that people were not aware of. And I'm probably fuzzy now on it compared to back then, but When the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu in 1954, I think it was, there were Geneva Accords which called for elections to take place for the new leadership of Vietnam. There was no North and South Vietnam, but there was a temporary, the leaders of the people that defeated Dien Bien Phu grouped in the North, and more pro-French, pro-U.S. forces grouped in the South. Anyway, there's supposed to be an election, and there's this famous quotation from President Eisenhower saying that if the election ever took place, Ho Chi Minh would easily get 80%.
Yep.
So they could not allow the election to take place. The United States was determined not to allow the election to take place.
Okay.
And so they never did allow the election to take place. And so everything that was done to support the dictators in the South was in violation of the Geneva Accords. So all the international law rationale for the war was bogus. It was a complete violation of international law
and U.S. policy. Were you aware of this right as it happened, as the elections were or announced that they weren't going to be held? Was that okay?
Well, there was an anti-war press.
Yeah,
with Ramparts magazine and other. I can't remember exactly. And we read them. We were educated, right?
I mean,
but this wasn't stuff you'd read in the newspaper. You had to be reading it in, anti-war literature.
Okay.
But the interesting thing was that in the teach-in that I described in the article, the government made it a point to invite a government pro-war spokesman. I think his name is Dean. He was the Assistant Secretary for Southeast Asian Affairs. He started giving the government's line,
and this is at the teach-in, or
at the teach-in,
yeah,
which was a huge number of people what's the name of the
Dartmouth Hall?
No,
Where on campus is it?
Right on the green, where the there's a big lounge and there's the wood shops and the music something. It's right next to the hotel.
Oh, the Hop.
Hopkins Center. Yep. There's a big lounge.
Yep.
There, and that's where the teaching was, and we had two mics for the people in the audience.
Okay.
And I deliberately did not have it be question and answer. It was you say whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
And there was the panelist, and there was the guy from the government, and he gave his pitch. And then there were college professors, like Ernie Young, and Kubrin, and others who I forget their names, who knew the history.
Yep.
And they told the guy to his face, "You're lying," And they rattled it off. They knew exactly what they were talking about. I remember at one point, the guy from the government said, "Well, but there's this book by Pike that says blah 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 blah," and the professor says, "Yeah, I know all about that book. It was commissioned by the CIA and blah 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 blah, and it's full of lies." Right? It was like total defeat.
Interesting.
For the guy from the government, he was just completely wiped out, and that caused this huge change in the people who came to the teach-in to see the pro-war side defeat the anti-war side. Mm-hmm. Saw the opposite, and they were they changed. I saw their faces, I could see it on their face. They changed from pro-war to anti-war, right before my eyes.
Interesting.
And it was quite amazing.
And did you notice more attendance in the meeting subsequently, and more students who may have been there attending, who you had not seen before?
Well, we ended up planning the building takeover, and then there was a student strike. So then the trustees had to fly in because the whole school was shut down by a student strike against the arrest of the people who took over Parkhurst, and the faculty then voted to abolish ROTC, and that was the demand of the takeover, and that was the supported by the student strike.
We'll get there.
so the trustees had no choice, basically, but to abolish ROTC.
Okay. And then it's that's I would recommend we take a quick break right now, and then we'll jump more into the details of the protest and the results of that.
Okay.
I'm excited to get to that.
Okay.
So this is the third audio file of the interview with Mr. John Spritzler. So where we were just discussing the teaching day that was held and organized by Mr. Spritzler's group, which it was, can you say the name exactly again?
The name of what?
Your organization. Was it
SDS?
SDS. Okay. Gotcha.
This was before the split in SDS, where the Weathermen, that was later in 1969.
Yep.
And the Weathermen were the famous group that were the crazies, and then the other group was the part we were part of.
Okay.
Do you want to hear the bombshell?
I do. Is there anything we should build up to before we get to that, though? Any more context?
Because
I just want to make sure we're at the point.
We're talking about the fact that there was a bunch of us that we were organizing against the war. We ended up having the teach-in.
Yep.
We ended up having the building takeover.
Yep.
We didn't talk about the building takeover, and President Dickey's recollection is wrong. He has me confused with someone else.
Okay.
I found online he was being interviewed, and he talks about Spritzler did this and Spritzler did that. It was someone else.
It wasn't you.
I'm not saying that the other person did something bad.
Yeah.
I can't even remember what it was. I just know it wasn't me.
Interesting. Interesting.
I had the name. It was name recognition. I was associated with the anti-war movement maybe more than other people, so he just sort of grabbed onto that
name. Grabbed onto that. Yeah. Interesting.
So here is an interesting fact. Before the building takeover, before... I don't remember if it was before or after the teach-in, but mm-hmm. around that time.
And what time is this exactly?
Well, the teach-in, let's see, I hung around after I graduated as an outside agitator. So the events of 1969 were events in which I had already graduated, but that was the building takeover. Mm-hmm. I think that the teach-in was either late 68, probably earlier 69. Maybe late 68. My memory is a little fuzzy on that.
Okay.
So around that time, in 68, I think what I'm going to say happened in 1968, maybe early 1968.
Okay.
A very high-ranking administrator of Dartmouth College, mm-hmm. whose name I will not say, came to me, gave me the key to the ROTC offices, and suggested that I burn them down.
Really?
Really.
Okay. Had this administrative figure been made his political beliefs known before? Had he ever worked with your group?
He had privately identified himself to me and my in a select number of very one or two of my comrades as sharing our anti-war beliefs.
Okay. And he gave you this key, and obviously you didn't burn down the RTC.
No, we talked about it. And we weighed the pros and cons. Interestingly, one of the cons that I don't recall even considering was that we might get caught. Somehow we didn't even consider that. Mm. But the main thing we considered is that it was politically a terrible idea. We wanted to build a mass movement against the war. We did not want to burn the ROTC building down and then have a mass movement developed against people burning buildings down.
Sure.
So it would have been disastrous from the point of view of building a mass opposition to the war if we had done it. And that's what we decided. So we just decided, no, we're not going to do it.
Describe some of the relationship between your organization and ROTC. What interactions between members of your group and them were like?
Nil.
Nil. Okay.
I don't think we knew anybody who was in ROTC except perhaps just incidentally, a roommate or someone might have been. But, we didn't confront them. We didn't want to confront them. We weren't trying to make enemies of them.
Sure.
It was just the principle of having a Reserve Officer Training Corps training second lieutenants for an unjust war. It's also interesting that I remember reading somewhere that the life expectancy of a second lieutenant in Vietnam was 2 weeks.
Okay. So it was less the individuals or, as you're describing, there weren't individual antagonisms?
No.
Okay.
No.
So much as the overarching.
And interestingly, our offices were one on the third, one on the second floor. I don't remember ever confronting an ROTC cadet and having an incident, interestingly.
Sure. Now, had ROTC, had that always kind of been a standout kind of point of contention for your group? Or was that kind of what was settled on for the college environment?
ROTC was the object of student anti-war activity in colleges all around the country. That was just a standard target for the obvious reason.
Yeah.
It was the most obvious way that that colleges were supporting the war effort.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, it wasn't like we're against the war, like how do we protest the war? It was more like this is the target.
Well, yeah. SDS was a national organization and we had to a certain extent, national discussions and strategies and so forth. And,
yep.
And fighting ROTC was something that happened at Harvard, mm-hmm. Columbia, lots of other colleges.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to what extent did you look to these other institutions, when you were, you're kind of trying to figure out, the best way to kind of spread your campaign and look at.
We did. Columbia, I think, was the inspiration for a building takeover.
Okay.
And then Harvard was around the same time. I can't remember what the chronology was exactly, but I was in touch with people in Boston because I was getting more and more involved with the Progressive Labor Party, which I ended up joining. Mm. And Progressive Labor Party was mainly focusing its attention on building SDS and abolishing ROTC with mm-hmm. mass actions like this. So that, it happened at Harvard, it happened at Columbia, and then we did it at Dartmouth, and I don't know how many other places did it.
Mm-hmm. And, okay, so there was a kind of intercommunication.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Discussions of tactics, discussion of...
When it came to tactics, we were sort of, on our own.
Okay.
And I tell the story in the article I wrote that I'm not positive that I know the name of the student, but I think I do, but I won't say it just because I don't want to say it wrong. But one of the students who was a year behind me, I think, in SDS, but not as active as others,
mm-hmm.
We had a meeting to plan for the building takeover. And it was a tactical problem because we had to gather our forces to be able to take over the building without letting the administration know too much in advance what we were going to do because
yep.
We were afraid they would stop it before it even happened. So we're having a meeting to plan this in the lounge of the Dartmouth Christian Union,
mm-hmm.
and this one fellow shows up with an electric drill and a lock and hasp. And I remember being surprised at seeing that. I said to him, what's that all about? And I remember him saying, well, if we're going to take over the building, we better be able to replace their lock with our lock. And it's the reason that stuck with me because that kind of concrete thinking was something we had never engaged in before.
Sure.
And the only reason that it was happening now was because this was immediately after we had discovered with this huge anti-war demonstration on the Green, provoked by the conservatives, that we were the majority.
Okay.
And so knowing that we were the majority changed everything. And it meant that you could actually start thinking about bringing an electric drill to a meeting.
and use it.
And use it, yeah.
Okay. Describe the protest in the Green. What led up to that?
Okay, well, what happened was there was this conservative organization called the Dartmouth Conservative something or another. They had a newspaper that they just started.
Okay.
It became famous in the 80s. It got this backing from people like Ronald Reagan's cabinet member, Bennett, I think, yep. And so forth. They ended up much later getting famous for mocking black students who were doing a protest of apartheid in South Africa. So they were racist, you know, pro-establishment racist types, led by a man named William S. Lind.
Okay.
And William S. Lind would walk around with his nose up in the air and sort of an arrogant attitude, and he had his little followers following him. And so they had this, the Dartmouth Conservative paper, whatever it was called, and the one issue came out that the headline was Splatter Warfare. And the article explained that by that they meant that that nuclear bombs should be dropped on North Vietnam. And as horrible as that was, even more horrible for us emotionally was that they announced that they were calling a pro-war demonstration for a month ahead, in advance, you know, the next month, to be exactly where our little peace sign was. It was to be at a Wednesday at noon,
mm-hmm.
right exactly where we always were on a Wednesday at noon with our peace sign.
Yeah.
You know, 10 of us would be there with the peace sign.
Mm-hmm.
So we dreaded the approach of that day.
Yeah.
And we anticipated being totally outnumbered by pro-war people. And as it turned out, it was the opposite, that there was about 50 people there with pro-war signs, and literally 1,500 people with anti-war signs.
Really?
We had no idea, right, that this was going to happen. 1,500 people with anti-war signs, and the line that they were in made like a snake going all around the Green.
Yeah.
And you know, if you had an aerial photograph, it would have looked like a snake.
Sure.
And that changed everything. For the first time, we knew that, you know, there were only 3,000 students on the campus.
And it was mostly students there.
1,500 were on the Green with a sign, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, I attribute that to some, partly to the work we had done with the teach-in, which had a dramatic effect.
Mm-hmm.
And also just to the general change in public feeling about the war that was happening in the country.
And it was mostly students who were there, the 1,500. Okay.
Yeah. So then we started having SDS meetings to plan. We knew that they'd done it at Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, we didn't invent the idea. But now it was up to us to make a building takeover against ROTC happen. So we planned it. You know, we came up with the strategy, the tactic, I should say, of, we called an anti-war demonstration in front of Parkhurst, which, you know, only certain inside people knew was going to be where the announcement would be to take over the building.
Mm-hmm.
And we did it. I remember.
So you planned it. I mean, what was the thought process? I mean, what were people proposing to do? Were there different, like, competing ideas, like, do we take over the building?
No, it was almost self-evident.
Really?
It was just take over the building.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so you take it over, and, like, from the outset, did you have an idea of how long you plan to be there?
No.
No? It was
take it over and let's see what happens.
Okay.
It turns out that the college was extremely prepared. I found out later with this woman I told you about.
Mm.
who might be booze, but I don't know.
Yep.
The college had already been engaged with meetings with the governor. They had already planned what jails people were going to be put in, which mm-hmm. deliberately scattering them all over the state. But we didn't know any of that at the time.
Okay.
So
do you know how they...
The only planning we had is we knew we were going to change the lock. Here's one thing that happened. We went in to the building. We told the deans, you need to leave. And they all did except for one. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember which one it was, but some dean, like on the third floor, Parker's, he was sitting in his chair, like a swivel chair behind his desk.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't leave. And we didn't have a plan.
I'll stop the recording for a second if you need anything. This is the fourth audio file of the interview with Mr. John Spitzler. We were just talking about the beginnings of the Parkhurst takeover and some of the tactics that went into that and the kind of thoughts that went behind it. So
we were on the third floor.
Yeah.
There was, I don't know, you know, six or seven of us, you know, around this dean in his chair mm-hmm. who was refusing to leave. We had no plan. Despite having no plan, we looked at each other, and it must have taken like 2 seconds. We just, without saying anything, we all grabbed the chair with the dean in it, mm-hmm. lifted the dean and chair up, carried the dean down 3 flights of stairs, and set him in his chair on the grass outside.
Did he say anything during the rest of this?
I don't know if he said anything. I can't remember.
Okay.
And that was the most violent aspect of the building takeover.
Okay.
And I'll admit, it was violent. We, you know, we forced him to do something against his will. Mm. And I think it was justified violence. And Dickey reports in his interview something, you know, sort of in the same ballpark, and says it was me, but it was someone else. And maybe other people did something else that I'm not aware of, similar, I don't know.
Okay.
But, you know, we were in different people were going to different deans, I guess. You
sure.
know?
Who were, I mean, I knew you were leader of the group. Who were some of your other co-leaders that, you know, that you're, that helped plan, that were really involved in the planning of this?
Well, there's John Ray mm-hmm. and Jim Van Hoy and Guy Brandenburg and Pete Meilenberg, and those are the names that I remember.
Okay. And you know, you guys were kind of, yeah, you know, were you in a formal role within SDS or?
There was a building and grounds worker that was also involved in our group.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And he was a campus employee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Did you have a formal position, or was there, I'm trying to get a sense of the structure of the organization on campus. And was it kind of like
was it formal?
Yeah.
No.
No. Okay. No, here's our president. Here's like that kind of, that kind of structure.
No formal offices, no elections, okay. No nothing.
And just curious.
It was basically you were
a member.
You acted and participated or you didn't.
Sure. Okay, so we're in Parkhurst. You've just lifted and carried the dean out. What happened?
There was a decision made very, very early on. Everyone knew that we'd get arrested, you know, that the cops would come. No one knew when or how exactly. Yep. But there was a decision made. There was a democratic decision made. There was some kind of vote. I can't remember the details. Mm-hmm. But there was a vote that two people should be... designated as two people who would not get arrested, who would, you know, when the cops came, would not be in the building.
Okay.
In order to have people outside to support, organize support for the ones who were going to be in jail. Mm-hmm. And the two people who were selected were me and John Ray.
Okay.
And I found out much later from someone talking about this, who told me that the reason I was selected was because I had already been arrested for another confrontation with Marines who were recruiting. And
can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I will. I'm saying it's a funny story, actually.
All right.
And so people thought that since it wouldn't be a first offense for me, it would be better if I was one of the people who was not arrested.
Sure.
I don't. Maybe that's true. Maybe it's not. That's what I was told.
Okay.
I actually flattered myself that it was because they thought I would be a good person to have as an organizer on the outside. So I don't know, maybe I was involved too. And John Ray was the other one.
What year was he?
I think he was the same year as me. I'm possibly different, but I think he was the same year.
Approximately the same.
Yeah. Okay. Our Ray was spelled R-H-E-A, I think, something like that.
Okay.
So you want to know about my arrest?
I do. Wait.
Okay. So
year, date, time.
So, just a little context. Back then, in contrast to now, corporations recruited on campus, and the joke was that there was only one criterion. It was called the mirror test, and if you passed the mirror test, then you would get a fairly high-paying entry-level job with full benefits and a career for life. The mirror test was that if they put a mirror in front of your nostrils, it would cloud up from your breathing. So basically, you had to be alive.
Yeah.
And a Dartmouth graduate.
Yeah.
Right? So in contrast to today, where kids graduate from college and they have to work for free as an intern if they're lucky, and then they barely get a job. So for them, my children have gone through all that. So, so anyway, getting it. By the way, the 1968 was a period when there was maximum equality in the United States, economic equality, and maximum job security.
Okay.
The difference between a CEO pay and an average worker pay was as small then as it ever was.
Okay.
Interesting context.
Yeah.
So in addition to corporations recruiting, the military came and recruited.
Yeah.
So the Marines came to recruit, and we decided to form a blockade to prevent people from going in and stop the recruiting.
Wait, was this a campus building? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It was some little utility building like
here or on campus?
On campus, yeah. I forget the name of it.
Okay.
It had, it was sort of, the entrance was sort of like a porch where you go up a few stairs.
Okay.
Sort of like a backdoor porch kind of entrance.
Okay.
It was right on the campus, like near, you know, what's the main street called?
Main Street.
Main Street.
Whatever. I mean, there's Wheelock and there's Main.
Well, the Main, near those, you know, okay. near the part of the green where the hotel is and everything.
Okay.
And the part where Robinson building is. It might have been the back door to Robinson. I don't know.
It could be, because Robinson does actually have that porch.
Yeah, it might have been that. So. Anyway, so we formed a blockade of it, right? And, you know, I was one of the people blocking the Marine. And I forget exactly what happened, but, you know, I tried to stop him and we tussled a little bit or something, and I think they got through anyway. But and then the next day, I was served a warrant for my arrest for assault and battery.
Okay. Who identified you?
Oh, it was easy. I mean, I was
okay.
Gotcha. Everyone knew me, right?
Yeah.
So the trial was scheduled, right? And I got an ACLU lawyer or something, and the trial was just about ready to happen, but then they dropped the charges.
Huh.
Now, why did they drop the charges? It turns out that if they hadn't dropped the charges, the Marine would have had to go on the witness stand, and assault means that you frightened a person with your fist or a gun or something, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a sort of a skinny kid then. Mm-hmm. I've gained weight since then. You know, I'm only 5'7"
Okay.
And so I was a sort of a skinny 5'7" The Marine was a husky 6'2" guy, right?
the guy.
The Marine authorities told him that there was no way he was going on the witness stand and asserting under oath that he was frightened by me. So they had to drop the charges.
And how did you find that out?
I can't remember how I found that out, but the lawyer found out or something and told me anyway. I found out. I couldn't make up a story like that.
Sure. No, yeah, it's a really funny story. The great Grafton County Superior Court. went to court there. Interesting. And was this when you're still a student?
Or? Yeah, I think I was still a student, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So that's why I had an arrest.
And they decided to send you out. So how long were you in the building with the group? At what point did you leave?
I think it was like 2 days or so. My memory's a little fuzzy, but I think we might have made it overnight, one night at least.
Okay. And was most of that spent up or where? Yeah. What was going on inside the building? What were you guys talking about? What was the mood like?
Trying to figure out when the cops were going to come.
Yeah.
paying attention to, to tell you the honest truth, I only have little snippets of memory. Mm. And I think I've told you my snippets, the actual, how your memory works, where you have little scenes that you recall.
Sure.
And I remember, we were, sleeping on the floor. Oh, I remember we went into the president's office and saw how gorgeous and luxurious his personal bathroom was. That was a big revelation.
You guys used it for showers?
No, I don't think so, but it was just, no one expected it, It was
Interesting. There's negotiations between, negotiations between the protesters and administrative figures and police, correct?
No, I don't think we had negotiations. Okay. Our demand was that they abolish ROTC.
Okay.
Or arrest us, There was no what was there to negotiate, right?
Okay.
And
so, so you're in there for 2 days, 2 days and 1 day approximately. How was it covered? Did you guys allow a reporter from the student newspaper?
I can't remember.
Okay.
Yeah. It must have been statewide news, though, I'm assuming.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
At what point did you decide to come out, or was it kind of forced by...
Oh, it was forced. The cops came and dragged people out and arrested them.
Okay.
There was no question of resisting, but, we weren't equipped to resist the police. Mm-hmm. So when the police came, they basically just grabbed people and arrested them. Everyone was arrested. There was no... As I recall, no one was given a choice to leave. And, we were all criminals, according to criminals who, and they put people in 40 different jails all over the. Well, maybe that's an exaggeration. I think there might have ended up being 40 people, by the time the cops came, 40 people still inside.
Okay.
And they were distributed to jails all around the state deliberately.
Okay.
To make it as inconvenient for parents to find their child, and because the parents came. One funny thing that came out of all that was I think at least two students who were arrested told me that when their parents came to try to get them out of jail and they talked to them, that they found out for the first time from their parents that their parents had been members of the Communist Party.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. McCarthyism made them scared to even tell their own kids. Mm. But they did now. The other thing that was really scuzzy is there was a fight over whether the students in jail could get books to study for their final exams. Mm. And the college was at first saying, no, they couldn't. And the reason was so that they would fail their final exams and then get drafted for failing, because that's the way the draft was at the time, and end up being sent to Vietnam, losing their student deferment. And they relented on that finally. There was a big uproar from the parents and everything about that and the students. And so then there was a student strike. Mm-hmm. And then the faculty voted to abolish ROTC, and the trustees flew in for an emergency meeting and abolished ROTC.
Interesting.
And then I was focused on organizing as many of the students as possible to go to the SDS National Convention in Ann Arbor, I think it was, to fight the weathermen who were, you know, basically trying to destroy the anti-war movement.
Sure.
But pretending to be the anti-war movement.
Okay. Talk about, you know, they went to jail. What happened immediately after the fact for yourself, for some other members of the group, you know, beyond just going to jail, like when you came back to campus? What went on?
Well, it was a victory.
Yeah, it was a victory.
The main thing was it was a huge victory.
Yeah.
ROTC was abolished for 10 years.
Yeah.
So it was a huge victory. And it was a sort of a celebratory kind of realization of that. There were some hardships with students in jail and, you know, having to pay lawyer costs and all that kind of stuff. But
yep.
it was a victory.
And did the administration take their own disciplinary action against students involved?
You know, I don't know.
Okay.
I was not a student at the time. I had graduated already.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something about my personal story about graduation.
Yeah.
And it must have been true for the other people involved in this. It was 2 weeks before my graduation.
Hmm.
I had fulfilled all my requirements except 2 weeks of classes, I call my father up, who's in Los Angeles. I tell him, Dad, I decided to drop out of school 2 weeks before graduation. He'd paid for all the tuition and everything, right?
Yeah.
I explained to him that the revolution was around the corner. College degrees, you know, were not important anymore. And I had things to do. I didn't want to stick around, you know, for those 2 weeks. I had more important things to do than to graduate from college. And he yelled so loud that I joke when I tell the story to people. I tell people that I could hear him even without the telephone.
No.
And he badgered me into graduating.
So this is
the
2 weeks.
So I think other people who were involved in this takeover.
Yeah.
You know, discipline, graduation, I think it was low on their list of things that they cared about.
Yeah. And so this is 2 weeks, your senior spring.
I'm sorry?
And this was your senior spring.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That you told them this. What made you think the revolution... You mentioned the revolution.
What made me think that?
Yeah, what made you think that?
It was 1968, or 69. Well, for me, it was 1968.
Yeah.
You know, 1968 was not just an ordinary year in American history.
Yeah.
It was a year where kids were thinking about dropping out of college 2 weeks before graduating. It was a year when jobs were low-hanging fruit. Anyone could get a job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one worried about being unemployed. It was a very different.
Sure.
Very different.
Interesting. So you stuck with it. You got your degree. You mentioned the aside about meeting the senator up on stage, and then you decided to hang around as an agitator.
Do you want to talk about what I did in the years afterwards?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Well, I ended up joining the Progressive Labor Party.
Yep.
Marxist-Leninist. Spin-off of the Communist Party, and the Progressive Labor Party first sent me to Connecticut with a handful of other people to organize. I hear it too, but I don't know what it is. To organize political support for students at the University of Connecticut, UConn, for Jim Sober, who was an SDS leader there who had been arrested for serious felony charges for leading a building takeover against ROTC. So I was there for about a year or so. And then I was asked to go with another married couple to Buffalo, New York, to organize an SCS chapter at UB, University of Buffalo, part of the University of New York system. Mm-hmm. So the focus then was fighting racism being taught on the campus. So I enrolled in Professor Halstead's history class.
Okay.
Now, I didn't need credit or anything. I was already a college graduate. Yeah. To be able to organize students.
Yeah.
And Professor Halstead's class was one in which he was a very authoritarian, Germanic kind of authoritarian professor. And he taught that European imperialism was good for the Africans because it civilized the savage Africans. And I made it a point of extremely politely, you know, raising my hand, only when called upon, politely expressing disagreement, for which he accused me of disrupting his class, because in his opinion, the most polite, orderly.
Give me an example. Like, would you like raise your hand and?
I raised my hand. You call me and say, "I said, Professor Halstead, I think that what you're saying is not true." Da, 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 da.
Yeah.
Okay. And I wasn't, you know, like filibustering. I was just saying it. But what really the reason that he attacked me is because we were leafleting the whole campus mm-hmm. about why what he was saying was wrong and racist. He didn't like being made the object of a campaign, right?
Sure.
What I didn't know was that there had been an SDS chapter the year before I arrived, which the administration had squelched, mm-hmm. and that they were determined to nip in the bud a new one developing.
Interesting.
I didn't know that. So he accused me of disrupting the class. There was a kangaroo trial, which I was convicted.
And this is through a student.
Okay. And so I was expelled from the university. And although the details of how it happened, I can't remember, I do recall that I think I'm the only one to have been expelled twice from that university. Anyway, as a result of that, I was not allowed to step foot on the campus.
Sure.
So, nonetheless, I went back on the campus, and during the afternoon at the student union, which is where all the students hang out during the, you know, lunch and stuff like that, I was passing out leaflets about this, and the campus cops came and arrested me, and I was arrested for trespassing. And so I figured, you know, the trial came, and I figured I might get a fine, a few $100 or something. Mm. Well, and I had an ACLU lawyer who was not a very good lawyer. The gavel came down, and I was sentenced to 3 months in the Erie County Penitentiary, which I served. One of the most interesting experiences in my life, actually. I'm sort of glad it happened.
Describe it. I mean, what makes you say that?
Well, first of all, nothing bad happened.
Yeah.
It was the Erie County Penitentiary. It's for people whose sentences were for 2 years or less. So these were not people in for life, like Attica, which happened near that time. You know what I mean by Attica, right? Yeah. So the people were mostly, almost all of them were people in for drug, you know, possession of drugs. Mm-hmm. With a couple of exceptions, I was basically the routine is I was in an we all had individual cells, so we didn't have a cellmate.
Yep.
And the cells were in a row of cells, which opened to an alley during the day, so you could socialize with your other prisoners during the day. Only at night you got locked up in the cell.
Sure.
So during the day it was either you were doing the work that you were assigned. And I was assigned to washing pots and pans in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Or you were just hanging out in the cell, which meant playing chess or reading or whatever, you know. So the really bad person was, unfortunately, the one that I was washing pots and pans with. He was a white guy. Most of them was almost all blacks, but this was a white guy.
Yeah.
And he was in for robbing auto workers, which there used to be auto workers in Buffalo at that time. When they got their paychecks, he had a team of women and walkie-talkies that he controlled the women, and the women would stick a gun in the back of the auto worker right after they cashed their paycheck.
Yep.
And robbed them, and this is what he did. So to me, he was disgusting. Mm. But the other people were just in for possession of drugs, and they're basically decent people. And I became fairly, you know, in the prison context, quite friendly with one in particular. And he sort of made it his job to teach me how to say, and I don't know if I can do it now, but you had to say it exactly right in order to be really accepted, right? To say, so what happened? Or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
The inflection had to be exactly right, though. And he tutored me until I could do it. And everyone had nicknames. So, of course, I was the professor. And there was this other guy whose nickname was the chief.
Yeah.
Because he was a Chippewa Indian.
Interesting.
And he was in for robbing people by sticking a pencil in their back and making them think it was a gun. And that's what he did on the outside. He showed me his rap sheet once. And he was like 30 years old, and half his life was behind bars going in and out.
Really?
For these robbery crimes, right? So when he was in the outside, he's not such a nice guy, right? Robbing people. But when he was on the inside, he was incredible. Because what he did is he was a self-taught jailhouse lawyer specializing in habeas corpus, which means the law regarding that whether they can hold you in prison or not. And he was the lawyer for the other prisoners, a tremendous, you know, help to them.
Interesting.
And this is what else he did. There was a dentist for the prisoners who was horrible. I didn't experience it personally, but I heard stories. He had utter contempt for the prisoners, you know, so he wouldn't give them Novocaine, you know, yank out of teeth. He was just bad, bad dentistry, you know, contemptuous of the prisoners and so on.
Yeah.
So the chief, while I was there, wrote this letter to the Surgeon General detailing all the horrible things that this guy had done over the years. And saying that he should not be allowed to have his license to practice, it should be taken away.
Sure.
And he was collecting signatures for it. He collected signatures from all the
guys,
patients who had been abused, right?
Yeah.
And he went to the dentist, and he showed the dentist the letter, and he said, "If you don't improve, I'm sending this letter." Things improved
overnight
dramatically. Overnight.
Interesting.
So that's what he did. I had tremendous respect for the inside chief, not for the outside chief. Anyway, you know, life was full of little things. They had to serve us nutritionally, you know, enough to keep us alive, right?
Yeah.
But they would play games with us. The prison administration, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches qualifies as nutritionally sound, right?
Yeah.
So one night they would serve us the peanut butter without the jelly, and then on another day, they would serve us the jelly without the peanut butter because, you know, satisfying the law, but turning the screws on us, right? So people would adapt to that by storing the peanut butter until they got the jelly right.
Yeah.
And so people would teach each other tricks, you know, how to use the radiator to heat something up and so forth. So that was life, you know, and I read War and Peace and Crime and Punishment, and the prison library had all the Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. I read all the Dostoevsky and Tolstoy novels my time there, and the days went by, and...
You're out. There was only 3 months.
It wasn't such a bad experience.
that's really interesting. Well, what did your dad think about your activism?
You know, he was sort of proud of it.
Really?
Yeah.
But in the sense that he agreed with you, or...
Well, he was proud that I had convictions and fought for them.
Okay.
Yeah. He was actually against the war himself. He told me, I think it was my sophomore or junior year, by the way, he fought in the Flying Tigers in World War II.
Okay.
You know, he had medals from World War II. He was a doctor in the Flying Tigers in China under General Chennault and so forth. So it wasn't like he was a pacifist or anything like that. And he was as patriotic as anybody else, right? But just as an example of how public opinion was then about the war, in my junior year, I think it was, he told me, he said, John, go to the psychiatrist, act crazy, and get out of the draft, by that way. So I tried it. You know, I could tell you my whole story with the draft. That's another chapter. But I did that. I didn't succeed. I don't think I was clever enough to do it convincingly, but that was my father's
suggestion,
advice to do that.
And your sister too. Did she have any particular thoughts on you being this involved? I mean, what was her?
She is not part of the story really at all. Yeah. She was in her own world, doing her own thing, suffering her own stepmother and dealing with that. And that's
fair.
Just completely unconnected story.
Gotcha. Are you two still close?
But I can tell you something about talking about the home scene. One year during school year, I was up to my neck in anti-war. Mm-hmm. I came home. My father had dinner for me and Lee J. Cobb. Do you know Lee J. Cobb?
No.
Well, he's a big Hollywood actor. He, On the Waterfront. You ever hear of that?
Yeah.
Well, it's Lee J. Cobb is one of the main actors, and Marlon Brando.
Yeah.
I think Marlon Brando has the "I could have been a contender" line.
Yeah.
And Lee J. Cobb is one of the other actors in it. He was a big-name actor, and he was known as a communist, and during the McCarthy period, he was, called before House Un-American Activities Committee. Mm. And, during that time, some people were principled and other people ratted on people, and I think he ratted. Although I'm not positive.
What makes you say that?
I think I heard it.
Okay.
I'm not sure. Anyway, so I thought, my father told me he was going to have dinner, for me and Lee J. Cobb and the families. Mm. So there we are, having dinner in Los Angeles. And I knew that he was a communist, and so I figured, well, he's against the war. You know what? He was totally for the war.
Really?
Yeah. And this is when a lot of people were against it now.
What year?
It was like 67, I guess.
Okay.
Totally for the war. It really disgusted him.
Huh.
Just a little anecdote.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of the right question. You described how at least on campus, student population, those supporting the war seemed to indicate steadily declined. What was it like interacting with those few holdouts who were still very
forward? We'd argue, all sorts of, you'd argue, sometimes scream, sometimes ignore them. It wasn't, a big part of the pro-war, anti-war hinged around how much you knew about it.
Yeah.
If you understood the government was lying, you tended to be anti-war because, the peasants were being murdered with napalm. There was the picture of that girl, running toward the camera naked with napalm. You either were horrified by that stuff, or if you supported it, the only way to support it was by believing government lies that somehow freedom was being defended. If you knew that even Eisenhower admitted that 80% would have voted for Ho Chi Minh, if you knew that, which most people did not, but when you find out stuff like that, it sort of takes the moral rug out from underneath your pro-war position.
Mm-hmm.
So we felt that we had a basis for talking to people who disagreed with us, which was to show them facts.
Mm. And see their response.
It wasn't like you're an asshole.
Did
you know that?
Sure.
Sure.
How often did you find professors weighing in on the debate on campus?
How often?
Yeah.
Well, there were the ones that we knew that were outspoken.
Yep.
There must have been a lot because they ended up voting to abolish ROTC. Well, I suppose part of the vote was that people who might have felt that if they didn't, the college couldn't operate. Because it had come to that.
Sure.
But there was a substantial opposition. Are you okay?
I'm going to take a quick break.
You need some more water?
And go. This is the fifth audio file of the interview with Mr. John Spritzler. After a momentary pause.
There was a dean who privately presented himself to the core of SDS as a fellow revolutionary.
Yeah.
And in addition to giving us the key to the ROTC building and telling us to burn it down, which we decided not to do, he had me out in the woods teaching me to shoot a rifle.
Really?
On the grounds that there was going to be shooting in the woods one day.
Yeah.
Yes, really.
Yeah.
You see how different 68 was from now? he took me... I'm trying not to identify him by saying things that identify him, because I'm not sure it's right for me to identify him.
Okay.
But he took me to a foreign country to meet revolutionaries.
Which country?
Well, I'm not going to say, because that would somewhat identify him.
Went to a foreign country with him.
So I flew to a foreign country with him and his wife and met the revolutionaries that he was involved with.
Okay.
And
this is
interestingly, they were in a country where there was a dictatorship and ordinary middle class people who would ordinarily be in like the liberal wing of the Democratic Party were illegal.
Mm.
So to be a revolutionary in this country was simply because you had been declared illegal by a dictatorship. They were doing things like teaching peasants literacy, which was illegal. So they finally met with me, and we were in a living room having this organized meeting of the revolutionaries. And after it occurred to me that our discussion was essentially no different from all the dorm discussions I'd been having at Dartmouth. it was basically the same kind of discussion, you know, trying to figure out the world and, you know, what to do and so forth. This person was not trusted at all by the Progressive Labor Party people in Boston that I was working with. Yes.
Yeah.
Not trusted at all.
What was the reason behind that?
And
just
what?
Because
dean administrators of colleges were the enemy at this time.
Okay.
And you know, I might just as well have been saying that there was a revolutionary cop, you know, revolutionary chief of police.
Sure.
You know, just not believable. But so eventually the people in PL told me and my close comrade student that we had to give this guy an ultimatum.
Yeah.
The ultimatum was if he wanted to still be considered by us as one of us, that he had to sell the house he was living in. He had to quit his job, sell the house he was living in, give the proceeds from the sale of the house to Progressive Labor Party, move out of state, get a job on the assembly line of an auto factory, and then he would be accepted.
Okay.
So obviously it was, you know, to make sure that he couldn't do that, right?
Yeah.
Guess what happened?
He did it.
He quit his job.
Yeah.
He sold his house. He gave me and my friend $10,000 in cash, which this was 1968 or so.
Yeah.
We took it down to the people in the Progressive Labor Party. They were shocked. I remember to this day, they were rubbing each bill, holding it to the light and examining it. They couldn't believe it wasn't counterfeit.
Mm-hmm.
Moved to another state and got a job as a factory worker and assembly line and automobile plant.
Mm.
And the people in Boston Progressive Labor Party still never trusted him, but the people in this other state did. He was recruited to the party.
Interesting.
And years went by, and he left, and now, you know, he's not even close to being a revolutionary. So he's managing his father's big business in a state I won't say.
Mm.
So who was he? Why, what, not who was he, what was his name, but what was this all about?
Yeah.
To this day, I have no idea. He could have been, he could have been a person trying to infiltrate the Progressive Labor Party.
Mm-hmm.
He could have been genuinely who he said he was.
And you traveled with this individual to another country with his wife. I mean, it sounds like you had a fair amount of time to get to know him.
I'll tell you something else that happened.
Yeah.
This is such a bizarre story.
Yep.
So after we come back from this country, we met this woman when we were in this country, a fellow revolutionary. She was an oral surgeon.
Okay.
And she was 35 years old. So I'm like 21, right? She's 35.
Mm.
So that's a pretty big difference when you're 21, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm not like a womanizer. I'm inexperienced with women, you know. So so I met her. You know, she gave us a tour of her hospital, mm-hmm. and told us about the political situation, and
sure.
had dinner, you know, once. A, and then we fly home, and then 6 months later, she comes to visit in Hanover.
Yeah.
And so the dean, his wife, and this person, and me, were having dinner, and the dean and his wife go into the kitchen, and all of a sudden this person is hugging me, saying she loves me, and will I come back and marry her and live with her in this, in her country?
Yeah.
I freaked out.
Kind of out of the blue.
Totally out of the blue.
Weren't in communication with this
totally,
person.
Totally out of the blue.
It's very strange.
And I couldn't help but think, you know, that this dean and this woman, it's a scheme, it's a plan. They're manipulating me. I'm being used, you know, for some reason they wanted me to be married to her in the country. God knows why, you know. So I pretty much cut off relations.
Was not the present more, but was this a country that...
Third world country.
Was where there was an active, you know, kind of... You know, political movement against the established, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough. That's interesting. You know, was there ever any more follow up with the dean? Did he ever you know, contact the group again?
About 30 years later, 60s. About 30 years later, he got in touch with me.
Yeah.
We had dinner occasionally.
Okay. Together.
And then
long since parted with the college.
Then I never trusted him, you know. Had, you know, but some reason I my one of my sons invited to have dinner with me and this dean.
Yeah.
And he starts talking about how he has a cabin out.
Is it what?
A cabin out in the woods in his home state.
Yeah.
And his wife tells me, yeah, but he's got guns there. He's got a thing about guns. He's got an obsession about guns, 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 guns. And he invited my son, like 14-year-old son, to go out for 2 weeks and spend 2 weeks with him in this cabin with his guns and stuff.
And this is a guy you'd not seen.
A guy I don't trust.
A guy you'd not seen for 30 years.
Decades.
Yeah. You
know? And then, to my extreme annoyance, he started going around my back, communicating directly with my son to get my son to go out with him. I mean, I put the kibosh on that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't trust this person.
Okay.
I did initially trust him very, very much.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that was a strange...
Yeah. And has there been any communication since?
No. Well... Actually, his wife might be on Facebook with me, but she for some reason she disagrees with me about Zionism, so I don't have anything to do with it.
Fair enough.
So that's a strange little
yeah. That is
little, story. And
it's hard to understand without more context.
He had me do the stupidest thing in my whole life.
Oh. Which
literally.
One?
As we're getting on the plane to go to this country.
Yeah.
He tells me to join him in going into the bathroom.
Yeah.
Tells me to sit in the stall, and he sits in the adjacent stall.
Yeah.
He hands me a heavy object wrapped up in toilet paper and says, put this in your back pocket.
Okay. And did you?
I did.
Yeah.
It was a gun.
Okay.
And we went through this third world country customs.
Yeah.
With a gun in my back pocket.
Were you stopped?
No. I wouldn't be here probably if I was.
Yeah.
This was before metal detectors and terrorism and all that stuff, so it wasn't as crazy as it might sound, but
sure.
It was sufficiently crazy. The stupidest thing I ever did.
Yeah. Did he ever explain why?
The gun was to be given along with a bunch of cash to his revolutionaries.
Okay. And it's a singular gun. It's not, it's not like a, you're giving a multiple, let's say, one firearm, a pistol or something like that.
Maybe he had one in his back pocket, too. I don't know.
Okay.
So there you go. That was 1968. That was why I wasn't at the Democratic convention protesting. I was in this other country instead.
Okay. How long were you there?
About a month.
Okay. And traveling, seeing the country?
A little bit, mainly waiting for his revolutionaries to show up.
Did they?
Eventually they did, but we had to wait for them. You know, sort of like waiting for Godot.
Fair. Fair. And did anything come a result of this this travel or other than the experience?
Except for this weird thing with the woman,
which
didn't result in anything either. No, nothing
did. Just occurred.
It just happened.
Okay. What did the other your peers think?
Sorry.
No worries. What did the other students in your group think about this?
It was a secret.
Secret.
That was another weird thing.
Yeah.
Here I was, it was me and one other person, right? And we're building this, anti-war movement and talking revolution and everything.
Yeah.
And only me and this other student know, or believe at least, that one of these deans is a revolutionary.
Yeah.
We can't tell anyone. It's a secret.
Interesting. Was this person in a position?
Except we told the people of the Progressive Labor Party in Boston. Yeah. You know,
was this person in a position of like pretty? What was his ranking on the administrative?
I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
But it was high.
Okay. Because I mean, that is something to consider because there's all kinds of levels of deans, at least from my point of view now. That's very, very interesting. Anything else like that occur? I mean, were there other attempts at people who you didn't perceive to be part of your group to try to join your group like
no.
that? No.
No.
Okay. So he was kind of one outlier there.
Yeah.
All right. So we can jump back to Lake Erie after you're arrested, and kind of walk out. What was going on for the couple of years after that?
Well, after I got out of prison, I only served. I got 2 weeks off for good behavior, so it wasn't the full 3 months. So after I got out of prison, I went to Boston, but when I was in Buffalo, I was going to Canisius College. I got some teaching credentials.
Yeah,
I did some substitute teaching, but I was blacklisted in trying to get a job as a teacher because of all the stuff that the arrest and everything.
And when you say blacklisted, what do you mean?
What I mean is this. I went for a job interview.
Yeah.
And he had a folder open, and I don't know, he went to the bathroom or something, and I peeked into the folder, and there were the newspaper articles about my being arrested. So it was pretty clear they had been distributed to,
sure.
to the people who might be hiring me to know
sure.
about it. So, So after I got out of prison, there was a split in Progressive Labor Party.
Okay.
And about 150 people in the Boston Progressive Labor Party split from the National Party. And those were the people I knew and trusted and was aligned with. So I went back to Boston to live in Boston, be part of that.
Sure.
And interestingly, the initial reason for the split was that the national newspaper, which is called Challenge, lied. There'd be a demonstration of 50 people, and the paper would say it was 500, you know.
Okay.
And it just lied whenever it was convenient. And so the people in Boston thought, oh, that's just wrong.
Yep.
So we split, and for a while we called ourselves, we tried to continue to be an organization, mm-hmm. called ourselves Party for Workers' Power.
Okay.
And we started having discussions about what did we think, because we were now freed from the sort of democratic centralist kind of relationship with the Progressive Labor Party. And very quickly we decided, you know, we're not really communists. Progressive Labor Party was always pro-Stalin, and most people didn't talk about it, didn't care that much about it, but
yeah.
The leaders were into Stalin was a great guy, you know. So we decided that, you know, that's not us, so we decided we're not communists. So then we started to have discussions, what do we believe? And we ended up, one of the first things that happened is we ended up expelling the leader of the Boston Progressive Labor Party because he was sleeping with other women.
Interesting.
And we thought he's being a jerk to his wife, you know.
Yeah.
And so we did that. And he really was a jerk. He's become an obvious jerk in subsequent years, but that's another story.
Okay.
But so then, around that time, that group was heavily involved in the busing crisis going on in Boston.
Yep.
Which you can read about, you know.
Yeah.
But the things that it did is it had a group called Better Education Together, BET, and this group was bringing black and white parents together to fight for what most black and white parents wanted, which was better schools, and the situation was that there was like a pincer movement to create a race war then, where both the racist chairman of the school system, Louise Day Hicks, who was an overt racist, was tacitly working with this liberal Judge Garrity, who was enforcing an order to integrate the schools that was that was designed to be so absurd in terms of logistics that it would necessarily have opposition that had nothing to do with racism. Mm. But then the opposition was channeled by the racist to have a racist framework, and it created a race war. And Better Education Together was aware of that, and was explicitly opposing it and bringing black and white parents together. And one of the main people who they ended up running for school committee was a man named David Stratman.
Okay.
Now David Stratman was. Secretly a member of the Progressive Labor Party. And David Stratman was a Marxist, because we were still Marxists, right?
Yeah.
We'd all been trained by Marxist thinking. And the training, to make a long story short, of Marxist thinking is that ordinary people are dehumanized by capitalism, have bad values, and it's the job of a Marxist revolutionary to turn them around and make them good.
Mm-hmm.
Because until you do that, they're racist, and now the more modern, they're racist, they're homophobic, they're complicit in U.S. crimes, bad, 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 bad. Mm-hmm. And so David was trained in that same way. So he starts getting involved with parents, and the parents, black parents especially, started telling him that his Marxist view of parents was wrong. And he was seeing things that were in conflict with this negative view of ordinary people. And he developed an insight, which changed my life. That's what I'm telling about this. he developed an insight, which is that most ordinary people try to shape the world, the little piece of it over which they have any real control, which is necessarily small, mm-hmm. with positive values of supporting each other and equality and deciding things democratically.
Sure.
And that the job of a revolutionary is not to change people from bad to good, but to help people succeed on a large scale in what they're already trying to do on a small scale. Mm-hmm. So David tried to inject this into the discussion that was going on with this breakaway party, but he was unable to succeed because mm-hmm. he was a secret member and he couldn't speak openly in his own name, and there was no one else who would do it for him who was in agreement with him. And so what happened was these 150 people withered away. They all ended up going
elsewhere.
Some became liberal Democrats, some just non-political, including me, by the way.
Yeah.
I became totally non-political in the whole decade of the 80s. Mm-hmm. I didn't know David. I maybe knew him to recognize his name, and that was about it. I wasn't close to him. And David ended up writing a book called We Can Change the World, which expresses this view and sort of illustrates it and elaborates on it. And he published it in 1990, and we still live in the same part of Boston, Jamaica Plain.
Yeah.
So I'd run into him occasionally at the grocery store that we shopped at. And, you know, one day he said, I've written a book. Would you like a copy? So mm-hmm. at this time, I'm working on my doctoral thesis for biostatistics. The last thing I need is to be diverted by anything, right? So I said, out of politeness, sure. You know, so he gave me a copy, and I read the title. It says, We Can Change the World. And I'm thinking to myself, what does this guy think? He's Lenin or something? But I read the book, and it changed my life. I ended up agreeing with it. It was an eye-opener. And that was around 1990. And so David Stratman and I and another fellow and so forth began trying to implement these ideas. So we ended up creating the webpage, newdemocracyworld.org, after we had a newsletter first, and then there was the period when people stopped reading newsletters because they were reading web pages, you know. And I started writing articles, you know, and so forth. And we tried to do things, and we had some successes and some failures. Mm-hmm. But my thinking evolved in this way to what I'm doing today. David unfortunately died just last March. And so the reason that I'm politically active like I am today, mm-hmm. my son is with me, likewise, and some other people, is because when I went into political inactivity for the decade of the 80s, what brought me out of it was this book that presented a different basis for hope and being able to change things. And it's on that new basis that I'm now, you know, politically active. So
interesting.
Yeah, had it not been for that, I probably would be like so many of the other people that I described, just not politically involved and blending in and, you know, giving up, basically.
Yeah, interesting. That's it.
So there.
The ebb and flow of it.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. I think that's a good place to stop.
Okay, good.
Yeah, that's it. That's
well, this was fun.
Yeah.
You get some of the old memory cells firing away. And
that is the goal. It's...